What we'll do is we'll take some questions because we've got a lot of information, and I'm sure that any one of us could answer them. So
I want to say something, Joe, because this was originally designed to be his Q&A. At dinner last night, we discovered he leaves today, and this is the only time the three of us are here in Nanaimo together. So he has donated his Q&A to allow us the opportunity to share with you.
I made the right choice.
Before we start the Q&A, just a few important instructions on Q&As. First of all, we have runners that once we pick someone up, they'll hand you a microphone, and you can stand and ask your questions. Please think about your question before you're going to ask it. Make it concise, and make it one question, not five questions in one question, please. We want to give an opportunity for as many as we can within the next 60 minutes to have this chance. Also, if possible, although I know many of you have personal questions, try to find a question that everyone can benefit from. Do we agree?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay, let us begin. Yes, please, right here.
Hi. My question is, what would happen if we brought 60,000 meditators together and went from city to city all around the world? Would that change things?
Well, I'll start the answer. Because we saw that evidence in one of the events that we did, a community of people in our work said, why don't we do a global meditation? So we have done four global meditations. The last one we had over 45,000 people around the world join. And there's been over 23 peer-reviewed peace gathering projects, over 60 different ones that have really been significant. And you know, it's lowered crime, it's reduced violence, it's increased economic growth. This is a collective consciousness. And so the evidence points the finger at it's going to require getting energy up into our heart. I mean, the Heart Math Institute has done some great work with it as well. And I was just with Roland McGrady in Paris just a week or two ago, and they're doing outstanding research that show that non-local communication is happening all around the world, and they're doing the proper science to validate it. And he's got a great paper. I'm actually a part of the paper. I just read it the other day, and it's fabulous. It's pointing the finger that it requires that open heart. That's when the field starts to expand. That's when we start getting non-local. That's when we start creating from the quantum. And then that energy can carry the right intent. Now, I have a caveat to that, though, because in some of the peace gathering projects like they've done in Washington, D.C., and Dallas, and these different places, they noticed the reduction in crime and violence. But a few months later, the crime and violence returned back to the same level. I started thinking about it. It's just not enough to think peace, you know? You gotta demonstrate it, you know? And that's how we become supernatural. When everybody else is angry and violent and judgmental, that's the time to show compassion and love. When everybody else is afraid and anxious, that's the time to show courage. And it may seem unnatural when we do it in the beginning, but if we keep doing it, what was once unnatural will become supernatural. So when you show peace and you demonstrate something that's unpredictable compared to other people and their reactions, people notice that. It's an unknown. And it gives them permission to do the same in their life. So the demonstration, going from thinking to doing to being, ultimately not only is putting that information in the field, because that's one way, but the other way is to, we're three-dimensional beings with senses and we perceive reality. So we have to see it, and there's just not enough evidence that allows people who are clinging to be afraid to do it because nobody else is doing it. That's why we're here, are we not? To lead by example in the world. So I think it's a great way to bring people together to create a collective consciousness, but then to be able to demonstrate it and not lose that coherence with your eyes open, and being able to demonstrate something that's even greater than what other people do. I think that is what also changes the collective. So that's my piece.
Everything Joe just said, and if you were with me for, how many were with me for my one day? This is why, thank you, it's a long time ago. This is why we began the way we began. We are conditioned to believe that we are powerless and insignificant beings that have no influence on our bodies, let alone on the planet. So to think that humans could somehow, a few humans could somehow influence what has happened on a global level. Even if you say you believe it consciously, your subconscious is so conditioned to accept your powerlessness. This is one of the reasons, I think, why it can become difficult. In some of my earlier books, I wrote about some of the early peace studies. I think Joe and I are probably referring to some of the same ones. Princeton University was doing some. The folks at TM, the Institute, were doing some. And one of the things that they found in specific cities, when people assumed this space of heart-brain coherence and they became peace in their bodies, there was a reduction in traffic accidents, emergency hospital room visits, violent crimes against people. But here's the thing, as soon as everyone stopped the meditation or whatever you want to call it, all those statistics reversed. And so the studies were discounted. They said this stuff didn't really work. It doesn't really work. So what this has led to, and where I'm going with all this, I'm going to go right back directly to your question. You asked if a certain, what was the number that you gave?
60,000.
If 60,000 people came together, obviously the more people, the more pronounced the effect can be. But what the studies now are showing, it's less about the numbers of people and more about the quality of the consciousness that those who are choosing to be in this space are creating, and it's less about something that we do in a moment in time and more about what we become in our lives. When we become that coherence in our lives, then the prayer never stops, the meditation never stops. And the this is a beautiful example of what I said to you on Friday. The better you know yourselves, the less you fear your own power. You have the power to shift the energy of the planet. You have the power to shift, just listen, you have the power to shift the energy of the planet. You can change the magnetic fields of the Earth. I'm going to talk about this tomorrow. I've already got my program for today, so tomorrow I'm going to really go directly into this. But this is where the science is leading, and the beauty is it comes full circle with our most ancient and cherished indigenous spiritual traditions. So if we live in our hearts, the world changes. And that's exactly what we're saying up here today. So thank you. Thank you.
I just want to add one thing to this. It's very interesting because we always have a feeling our thoughts are contained in our head. And as Joe and his experiments reveal, they put electrodes on your head and you read your brain activity. What's interesting, that's called electroencephalograph. There's another way to read brain activity, it's called magnetoencephalograph. Now, what's different about it is in electroencephalograph, the electrodes are right on your head and you're getting conduction from electricity in your brain to your skin and then you're reading it. Magnetoencephalograph, the probe is out here. It doesn't even touch your head. And why is it important? Because you think your thoughts are contained in your head. It's absolutely not true. You are broadcasting. Your brain is a tuning fork. Now, when you get 60,000 people and you amplify each tuning fork, like Greg showed, when Joe showed the metronomes, when they were all out of sync, there wasn't any power to it. But as soon as they started to come in sync, they amplified in power. So when you get 60,000 people together, you're broadcasting a field. And it's interesting because it's like crowd response. It could be a positive or a negative. I mean, riots break out and pacifists in a riot will be caught up in it themselves. And I say, why? The field is overriding their own consciousness. And so as long as people are doing the meditation, as long as they're working on it, the field exists. And as Greg just mentioned, when they went home, the field disappeared again. And the idea is, we don't have to, if we just come together and say, oh, this one time we're all going to be coherent, and then we go home and then it all falls apart, what if we're coherent every day? If we're coherent every day, it never stops. So the whole idea is this. A, it demonstrates that the mind can change the field, and the field can change all the people. B, since we can do it, the question is, how come it doesn't last all the time? And the answer is because we're not in that state all the time. And if we became in that state, it would go on continuously and never stop. So the experiments are great, because they reveal that it does work. Now the idea is, well, let's make it work better by having more and more people stay in this mental state. And it's interesting because, as Joe beautifully showed, when you get enough people in the room together, the whole damn thing elevates like this. But what if you went home and you were always like this, and everyone was always like this? Wherever you are, the field would be like that. So it's a learning phase. A, does it work? Yes. B, can we now practice it and make it become a way of life? And if it's a way of life, we don't have to gather together. Wherever we are, we're going to be broadcasting the same frequency. And this is our future. It's community. It's coming together in harmony. Yes. We perceive ourselves as individuals, except the world is not based on us as individuals. It's based on us as a community. Nature doesn't give a damn when they say, oh, we have some great humans. You know, we have Beethoven and Picasso. And nature says, yeah, but look what you've done to the planet. Nature doesn't care about the individuals. Nature cares about the group. And this is the time for us as people to come together and recognize collectively as a group, we will change the evolution on this planet, and that's what's happening at this very moment.
Thank you. Let's see what happens tomorrow when we get 1,300 people. To create that coherence. We'll see what happens.
Lines.
Yes. Yes. For your right.
Joe, I was wondering if you could help me out. I'm not only a believer, but a perceiver. I've experienced some of what you talked about, but I have family members and a friend who has some real wicked degenerative diseases and could be completely helped by what you do. Could you speak to, I don't know, get brain scans of people who were reluctant and did some of this stuff, but can someone who is nudged to go, or like, what do I do about my family?
Even Jesus had problems with his family. I'll speak to it on two levels, because, I'm witnessing things, as I said yesterday, that I thought I'd never see in my lifetime. And people usually come to the end of their emotional belief where they've run out of choices, run out of options, where they finally decide to surrender. And the question is, how bad does it have to get for certain people to realize that no chemical, no drug, no therapy is really going to change them enough where they have to make up their mind to do it themselves? Now, when you have family members who share similar genes, you've been conditioned and live in the same environment, you have similar traits, propensities, emotional states that are very similar, so our family tends to be the most like us. And so when we talk to our family, and we're saying, you should try this, or you should do this, and they're not really looking at what you're listening to, what you're saying, they're looking at who you are. You know, they're looking to see if you're that. And they make that perception in a sweep very quickly. And so what I've witnessed is that people that are truly in that state all the time, or have made significant changes, and they're, I always tell the advanced students, you know, when you're changing, you stop talking about it. You're too busy being it, and everybody all of a sudden starts to notice that, and they want to have what you have. So the best way to influence family members, of course, speaking from my present state of ignorance, is to be the demonstration of that for them.
Yes.
Not fake it till you make it, but do the work so that you're in a different state than them, and you're no longer in that same cultural tribe as you once were. That was the beginning stages. You've kind of evolved out of that. And they see that, and because they see it, they naturally want more of that. Point number one, you got that? Now, in our week-long events, we just did an event in Berlin for 1,300 people there. And I'll be very very honest. There was a man there that was had a doctor's degree in law. And my staff was trained by me to not stoop emotionally and react to anybody in the event or to keep their energy up. The moment they react, they're the same energy. And this guy was the biggest challenge that they've ever had. And he was abusive, he was mean, he was disrespectful, he was overt, he was loud, he was very self-centered. And my staff on the evening, you know, dinners would say, "He's a hard guy to love, man. He's a hard guy to love." And the short story is that he had a stroke 3 years ago, and he was paralyzed on one side of his body. Now, with a stroke, when you have a trauma to the brain or a lesion to the brain, those nerve cells, usually according to the medical model, you have about 2 to 3 weeks, and if they come back online, you're lucky. But if they don't come back online, paralysis typically stays for the remainder of your life. And so he was very unhappy, and he was punishing people so that they could experience his own unhappiness. Do you understand?
Yeah.
And I told the staff that, and I said, just keep him moving. And he came because his wife dragged him there. He didn't want to come. And we do these healings as a group in our advanced workshops, and I do not do them at the beginning of the event because people have to get beyond themselves, and they have to be able to stay connected to that field, and they got to be in heart coherence. And when it comes time to raise the energy, they have to be in the right state, and they can't be thinking about my back hurts or how long is this going to go or am I doing this right. They left that on the first day. You understand?
Yep.
As the energy builds, you create these things called cage, and he laid down for a cage healing. And there was a doctor from Yale University named Harold Saxton Burke. And he studied the electromagnetic fields around eggs, from salamanders to chickens to all kinds of reptiles and birds. And what he found was that there was always right where the head was on the egg was the strongest charge, the positive charge. And the tail was the weakest charge. And if you have a negative charge and a positive charge, you have a magnetic field. That's what a magnet is. So he realized that the field that was surrounding the egg was in the exact shape of the egg. And so then he started studying different rodents. And he came across these rodents that had a propensity towards uterine cancer. And he noticed that every single rodent that had the uterine cancer had the same pattern in the field. But he found a group of rodents that had the pattern in the field but didn't have the uterine cancer yet. But every single one of them that had it in the field ultimately developed cancer. So he scratched his head and he said, it's not matter that emits the field. It's the field that creates matter. If you change the field, you will change matter. So that is the model that we use. Now this guy laid down. Now remember, he's closed off. And those people, they opened their hearts, they got beyond themselves, they connected to that field, and they lit him up. And he was sobbing. He had never felt love like that in his life. His body was quaking on the floor. And he wasn't even being touched. I was watching it. He came out of that 10, 15 minute process. His arm was paralyzed for 3 years, lifting his arm up. His wife is in tears because she's getting her husband back, and he is now more loving. She gives up her position for him to do it again. He goes back the next day, I light him up again, and now he's walking without a crutch or a cane. And they sent me the video just the other day. And that to me would seem like an impossible situation. Somebody would like that would actually respond. And it made me wonder that maybe you don't even have to believe in this. If the field is strong enough, it could literally begin to affect people in certain measures. Now, of course, belief and the ability to accept it allows it to happen easier. But I was stunned by the fact that you change the pattern, you have to get beyond the frequency of light. You have to move beyond three-dimensional reality to do this. But I was really stunned to see that nerve cells that were technically dead
of a sudden, in order for him to have motor function again, you have to scratch your head and wonder what the hell just happened. So even though he was closed off, on some level, he was open. You know, I mean, there's always some level we're opening. And I've had some great conversations with Bernie Siegel, you know who Bernie Siegel is? And you know what he says, you know, like tenacity. Tenacity is one of the things that helps us to heal. And as upset and angry as this guy was, I just saw the video of him talking to me. They sent me a video. He's all heart now. And I said, Max, you stay in that heart, Maximus, as much as possible. And I was typing, I typed it to his team leader, and she typed the text back, and he typed back, love is the only answer.
Because a lot of us also have friends, families, personal people that we see in trouble all the time. And then we have some understanding like, oh my God, they don't have to put up with that. We can help them. The problem is this. If they're not ready to be helped, nothing you do is going to change that. And that's the most frustrating thing, because you put all your effort into helping them change and they're rejecting you. And it's not a personal thing. It's basically they have not really committed to making a change. And it's the most hurtful part because they're friends, family, community that you know, and you go out of your way to do it, and then you don't get the response back. And it just psychologically is really a very heavy load. So the first thing is this. You can offer your help, but do not expect that they necessarily will respond to anything until they're ready to do that. That will take off a lot of pressure on you because you're waiting for them to do that thing. And I just want to add something really helpful because Joe just brought it up. And that is this. I was fortunately to be in the right place at the right time, got a download from the universe, and all of a sudden I saw, oh my God, you know, my whole world just changed, and I saw that if you understand what I'm talking about, you can create the most fabulous life on this planet. And I got so excited, I wanted to get people, I said, come on, and listen, I gotta tell you the story. And I get a few people in there, and I start telling them, if you understand what I'm talking about, you create this fabulous life. And they started listening, but about midway through, their heads are cocked a little bit. And they're going, you know, Lipton, your life doesn't look that good for a guy who says you know that. But it was the most important wake-up call, and I want to bring it to you right now as well. And that is this. What we're hearing, what we're experiencing today is going into conscious mind, because that conscious mind is creating, picks this stuff up. The question is this. Does it translate into subconscious behavior, which is running 95% of the day? The answer is no, not necessarily at all. So we all can walk away from here going, oh my God, I got the answers, I got the way out, I got all this. The question is, will it change your life? And the answer is only if you make an effort to put this into your subconscious programming. If you don't do that, then you've had a wonderful life experience. If we give you a quiz, you'll get 100, but your life is going to be exactly the same as it was before you came in here. So the most important part between Greg and Joe offering you all this information, this is great. It's going to educate that conscious mind. I need you to understand, I want you to take it from the conscious mind, and you have to make it part of your life. If you don't make it part of your life, you'll pass a quiz, but you'll fail at life. And that's the basic
I had an accident, I was brain dead, and I had an experience where I was just like in a void, where it was just love, it was all empty, but it was full and complete, and it was like being in eternity or the field or whatever, but I didn't know I existed as a human. I didn't know I ever existed. It was like I was just in the field and no person. And then as I get to myself, I'm like, oh my gosh, what is this? And it felt like I was a magician suddenly popping out of the field. But whatsoever, I'm now a person again, and I want to be that void in this person, you know, like that state which I believe is in living in from the heart. And then just being that in the heart and you know, envisioning some kind of life doesn't really matter. It's like it's just a matter of being and then living from that beingness. But at the same time, we talk a lot about envisioning and the future and but what is that to envision in a way? Like, can you just be in that beingness and you're at peace? And it's just a connection between the beingness and then the envisioning, you know, as a human and the creation.
Why is that question?
So the question is, you know, can I just be the rest of my life, just be love and peace and live in my heart? But at the same time, I'm a creator, I'm a human, you know, so it's like, you know, I'm the oneness, but I'm also the duality of a human.
Thank you.
So, you had the opportunity to experience that funk and feel exactly the way we discussed it yesterday. Yes? It's void of anything material. And you as a consciousness are no longer an identity or personality, but you're a consciousness connected to the consciousness of that field. Your consciousness is merging or one with that field. Some people came up to me and had very profound experiences in surrendering to that level completely, to lose themselves in nothing, to become everything. Now, you don't have to die to have that experience. You don't have to have a trauma to have that experience. You don't have to have a head injury to have that experience. You actually can get good at having that experience if you keep practicing connecting to it. And surrender is a process. Certainly the way I surrender to that field today is very differently than when I did just a year ago, because I know it's real. And people will tell you that they believe the quantum field is real, and just like Bruce said, it's an intellectual process, the conscious mind, but they haven't experienced it yet. So they'll say that they do, but when you ask them to close their eyes and connect to that field, they just think they're looking at the, you know, the back of their eyelids. They don't really understand as an awareness that this place exists, that it's real. If you can begin to make that connection in your brain and believe that that power lives within you and all around you, you wouldn't get up until you make contact with it because you know it exists. Now, it's no longer just God lives within me. Now, you know it does. So then, people who have that experience, I mean, I was just with Anita Morjani and we did this cruise together. And, you know, we had this great time. And, you know, those scans that I showed you, you know, many of those people are having the same experience as a near-death experience. They're having an interdimensional experience. They are transcending of this three-dimensional realm, and they are having a very profound mystical moment. And the biggest lie that we've ever been told as human beings, that we're linear beings living a linear life, I swear to you, we are dimensional beings living a dimensional life. And all of those dimensions are existing in the eternal present moment. And when you keep working on surrendering more and more into the present, you will begin to elongate time. And the more you elongate time, the more dimensions or space can exist in time, and that's the quantum. So people have these experiences and they tap into this level of love that is the most familiar, unfamiliar feeling you'll ever have, because it is you, it's a distant you that you're connected to, and you realize it's always been there. Now, your creation of future experience that you may want to have, like when I tasted that wine, when I tasted that experience, there's nothing else that I want. I mean, I don't really want anything material. I have all of that. What I want is more of that. And I want more and more of the exploration or the mystery of myself, who am I, to be revealed. And the more I understand who I am, the mystery gets more exciting. I have more questions. And so then, every experience then that I have that is an unknown experience, from that moment I can dream new dreams based on that last experience that I could never dream without that experience. So it's not about the car, or the house, or the hairdo, or the wardrobe, or any of that stuff any longer. It's about connecting to deeper and deeper levels of orderliness, wholeness, and oneness. And that could be the dream of your future. So now, 1 foot in the real world, 1 foot in the quantum world.
You live in a three-dimensional reality in a body. You have senses, you have this you're a biological entity, and you have to be able to navigate through life. You came all the way down from singularity and source, all the way down to density. You live, and you start asking questions, is there more? Who am I? What's the purpose of life? Those questions awaken the soul. The soul wants to journey back because, as I said yesterday, when you're the intelligence or the consciousness of everybody, everyone, everything, everywhere and every time, it gets pretty boring after a while. So the divine said, is there more? The moment you ask the question, is there more? There's got to be more because you're God. So then it creates a separation between two points of consciousness, free-willed individual beings and the unified field. And we descended from that singularity to answer the question. And there's journey, we're all journeymen and women on the journey. And so now as we start elevating our consciousness and our awareness, if you can heal yourself, or you have a mystical experience like that, the next question is, what's next? Can I heal somebody else? Isn't that an experience on the way back to singularity? You heal someone else, well, I can heal someone on the other side of the planet. Well, what knowledge do I need to apply? Well, consciousness has gone local. Okay, let me build a model in my mind, let me try it out. Now you do that, and you say, if consciousness is non-local, then I should be able to be somewhere else, consciously. And as you continue to evolve that, the dream changes. It's no longer about wealth or success or beauty, whatever it is, popularity. It's really about that journey to prove to yourself that when you finally arrive back at singularity, you say, there was a lot more, way more than you could ever imagine, I'm here to tell you. And then you dump that knowledge into the mind of God, your experience and your wisdom into the mind of God, and that's how God gets to know itself. So then, you have to function in a three-dimensional world. That means you're going to be challenged and initiated with those things in your life that have been created from an unconscious program. And you're going to have to go to a greater level of consciousness than the consciousness that created that problem, which means you're going to have to learn and become more aware, and then apply that knowledge to transcend that initiation or that challenge. Most people who are unconscious see themselves as victims, that they don't have any choice or ability to change. But now you know that. So you may not want everything material that other people in the world want, because that's how they've been programmed. But you may have a passion for the divine. You may have a passion to connect. You may have a passion to be a healer. You may have a passion to have mystical experiences. And that's only equal to your ability to have the knowledge to dream or the experience to dream the next dream. But what we think enlightenment is, what we think spirituality is nothing like what it really is. And every time I have one of those moments, as I said this morning, I always say I got this all wrong. It's the first thing I say, because some level, some veil is removed, and I see something differently, clearer, and I laugh because I can't be the same person after that. So you have to still function in the three-dimensional world, and you have to be able to connect to that field and then ask the greater question or create the next experience or surrender more to the greater experience. And by the way, every time I have one of those moments, I always say, there cannot be any more love than this. There just can't be until the next experience. And then there's more order, more oneness, more wholeness, and you can't go back. So I think that's the evolutionary process. We just can't be, and because you have to function, you still have to eat, you have to make a living, we're not at that point yet. So we have to navigate in the three-dimensional world, and the practice is being able to bring that into our lives and to sustain it and become it constantly and get better at it, and modify our behaviors, it's plasticity, to understand that we can continue to evolve and face the same challenges from a greater level of consciousness or a greater level of mind. And of course, certainly somebody in the world at some point has had similar experience as you. And someone must have written about it or talked about it. Go find that person and be able to integrate their experience to help you evolve. And that becomes the exciting part. And so it's no longer just mystically hanging out in a cave. And you go to the cave, you spend 6 months in a cave to change who you are, so when you walk back into the world, you're not the same person. But it is about plain demonstration. We have to demonstrate this in all areas of our lives. And as we said, when you do, you give people permission to do the same, because they're going to relate with you as somebody that's different and unpredictable. And I think that's how we begin to change the world.
Bravo.
Thank you.
just said.
So behind you.
You're with me on Friday?
And yeah, you know, it's standing.
I spent a lot of time in Tibet in the 90s asking questions like Joe was just talking about, and questions like you just asked. And one of the questions, my Tibetan is terrible, so it was all done through translators. And one of the questions I asked the abbot of the monastery while we were there was precisely what you're asking: when these people have dedicated their lives to achieving these deep states of awareness and altered states of consciousness. And I said, well, you know, how do you maintain that state? And he said, why would you want to? He said, the point is to know that it exists, to know the power of living in that state, and then to bring that into this world. But what he said to me after that influenced me. It just affected me very powerfully. He said, because it's easy to live in a world of nothingness, if all there is around you is nothingness. So there's no challenge. No one is challenging your belief systems. No one is hurting you. It's easy to live in that space. He said, the task of the devotee is to not use this as a refuge away from the gift of the experience that you've been given in this life. And then what he said, this is so powerful. He said, our capacity to love is defined by our capacity to hurt. It's only through the deepest hurts, the deeper the hurt, the more love it takes to embrace and heal that hurt. And every one of you in this room, we've all been hurt, and some of you are hurting right now. I'm losing a friend this weekend, and I'm hurting because of that. But what I remember from that conversation was, and I tell myself this all the time, every time I allow myself, I surrender to my hurt. I don't try to discount it. I don't try to blow it off. I may not do it right here on the stage in front of you right now, but I will surrender to my hurt of losing my friend. And every time we surrender to a deeper hurt, what we do is we build a greater capacity to love. And that love is what we're bringing from that realm into this realm. So it's about walking between two worlds without judging one or the other is right or wrong. And I just wanted to share that with you.
Starting to read about lucid dreaming, and you've spoken about lucid dreaming a couple of times. And so how does that interface with everything that you've been talking about yesterday and today?
I chase the mystical. I mean, that's what I love. And, you know, those scans that I showed is a greater degree of lucidity. In other words, person's waking up. When you wake up with a greater energy, you become more aware. And that super level of awareness is super consciousness reflected by those very high frequency, again, brain patterns with a lot of energy in the brain. So I've been interested in it, and I wrote this article years ago. I found these articles by this one researcher that I admire that was studying the derivatives and the metabolites of pineal gland, melatonin and serotonin. These particular chemicals, like when you're picking up the wavelength of light, like right now you're perceiving light, the wavelength of light is being translated to the back of your eye, and then it's signaled to this nuclei called the suprachiasmic nuclei, which signals the sympathetic nervous system, which switches on the pineal gland to make serotonin. And serotonin is kind of the daytime neurotransmitter, and it wakes you up. And your brain waves go into beta, and you're aware that you're in space and time. When there's an inhibition of light, the loss of that wavelength of light begins to diminish the amount of serotonin made, and then all of a sudden, pineal gland through the same system begins like an alchemist taking serotonin, and just through just a few small chemical reactions, begins to make melatonin. And melatonin is a nighttime neurotransmitter. It makes you sleepy, and it heals your body, and it creates restorative sleep. Brain waves slow down. There's antioxidants. It's an antioxidant function. It relaxes you. It does all these different things. It helps helps cellular repair, just on and on. So Sarah gets you up in the morning and Mel puts you to bed at night. And but it's a responsive function of the wavelength of light. And unless you're one of us three, you normally have a rhythm where your body is adapting to the environment. But you know, if you're on six or seven different time zones, your body is usually a little out of balance. So that's called a circadian rhythm. And melatonin levels are at their height between 1 and 4 in the morning. Now, what I realized, and what all a lot of these scans are related to, is the activation of that little gland called the pineal gland. Now, the pineal gland, I showed those rhombohedral crystals. The article said that they're stacked on top of each other. And the pineal gland then has a couple different specific functions. It has piezoelectric properties, and that function is when you take a mechanical stress and you start compressing those crystals, that'll begin to translate into an electrical charge. And that electrical charge begins to activate that latent system in the brain. And when that system begins to become activated, what happens is compression begins to cause a resonant field to begin to be created around the system. And that field expands far enough for the crystals to stretch. And when they can't stretch anymore, the field reverses. And when the field reverses, it produces another compression of the crystal, which then causes another field. And all of a sudden, you have this little antenna that begins to function. Now, this is my theory, of course, by studying all these articles. When energy moves from those lower centers, once it moves right to this center, even the HeartMath Institute has proven this, and we've seen this, once it makes it here, it's going to go all the way up to the brain. And when it makes it to the heart acts as an amplifier to drive the brain into higher degrees of coherence. It enhances brain coherence. So when the pineal gland gets activated, you're going to begin to pick up frequencies that are faster than the speed of light. Now, you're no longer perceiving quantum with your senses. Your senses plug you into this reality. So if you close your eyes and you're waking up at 4 in the morning and the raw material for lucid dreaming is right at its height. And I've done this so many times. When I was chasing mystical, I wake up at 4 in the morning, 3:30 in the morning, and I knew that the pineal gland had all those metabolites, all those derivatives. And I would just do my meditation and I would rest my attention in that in space that that gland occupies in space. And then I would begin to activate it. And when my body wanted to lay down, I wouldn't lay down. I would keep it sitting up a little bit more. Then when I laid down, I would put something under my knees so that when I laid down, I wasn't just associating that laying down with sleep. I was just in a little bit of a different position. And many times, I would have these very profound lucid experience. I would wind up in the refrigerator between two cucumbers. I mean, crazy stuff would happen. And you know, after a few of those, you could care less about what's going on in the news. And it just was crazy. And so there's a researcher that found that when the pineal gland begins to produce melatonin and the gland begins to pick up a frequency that's faster than the wavelength of light, we're going quantum, because Einstein said the ceiling of three-dimensional reality is the speed of light. Anything that travels faster than the speed of light turns into energy. So the frequency that exists beyond light, the pineal gland is able to transduce that frequency into profound imagery. And you saw on those scans that the limbic brain, right where that system is located, the pineal gland is very activated, and it begins to release an upgraded form of melatonin. Two of the most powerful antioxidants known to man. Now, melatonin is already an antioxidant, but now it's an upgraded version of those antioxidants, anti-cancer, anti-aging, anti-heart disease, anti-stroke, anti-neurodegenerative, anti-inflammatory, antimicrobial. You take that molecule and you tweak it again and you get benzodiazepine. What's that? Valium. So it begins to anesthetize the analytical mind. And Valium, those benzodiazepines, they fit beautifully right at the receptors in the amygdala. And it begins to silence the circuits that have to do with fear and anger and pain. And the only thing we tend to feel is this kind of insane sense of love. and it anesthetizes the thinking brain, which means our brain waves are going to slow down and you're going to chill out a little bit more. Now, melatonin already causes you to relax, but now you're going to really relax. You take that molecule, you tweak it again, you find the same chemical found in hibernating animals. And why is that important? Well, the body goes into stasis. No sex drive, no appetite, no preoccupation with the outer environment. Perfect state where the body would want to go. You would want to go within without being preoccupied with your body. You take that molecule, you tweak it again, and it's the same chemical found in electric eels. The biophospholuminescent chemical, those high amplitudes. And just like an electric eel becoming very activated, the nervous system switches on, and I think that that's what's creating those high amplitudes. You take that molecule, you tweak it one more time, and you have dimethyltryptamine, the most powerful hallucinogenic known to man. Now, many people who do plant medicine, they do that for the experience of seeing the world through another lens. And I think it's great for to try a few times, but you know, you gotta come back and function in your world still, you know? So when the pineal gland switches on like this, you're not just getting dimethyltryptamine, you're getting the whole package. You're getting all those derivatives. And when that happens, your inner world is just gonna become more lucid and more real than the outer world. In fact, this world is going to disappear. And you are going to swear that wherever you are there. And if experience enriches the brain, and it does, and experience produces an emotion, and it does, in a second then, you begin to reorganize the circuits in your brain based on that experience. And I believe that when you do that enough times, when you step out and open your eyes into the world, your brain is now wired to perceive now more of a greater spectrum of reality because of that inner experience. And now, all of a sudden, we're becoming more aware of the world. So, it's important to understand that you have some of those hallucinogenic chemicals. They're also found in schizophrenics too, you know, and certain people, when you have those moments, you can't quite get back into the world yet, you know? I mean, you're not ready for politics. You're not ready for TV. You're not ready for people complaining. You're just not ready for that. And so it changes you on a very deep level. And so the brain then begins to process a different stream of consciousness, and that consciousness is carrying that energy, is carrying information. And consciousness moving through the brain is called mind, and all of a sudden, you're in a different frame of mind. So, many people have lucid experiences, and the name of the game is that when you're in those experiences, to stay conscious, that you can actually navigate in those experiences, and that world, imagine, could be as real as this world, or in fact, more real. Then all of a sudden, you start to ask what's real, and you become less interested in so many of the mundane things, and you're more interested in things that awaken you. So lucid dreams have everything to do with that latent system of melatonin and its derivatives. Now, some people, I believe, just naturally have more of those derivatives than others. They tend to be a little bit more laid back, and a little more relaxed. You know, cortisol levels go up, melatonin levels go down. You know, I mean, that makes sense. I mean, if there's a predator outside the cave, it's not a time to sleep. So it's melatonin levels go down, and some people just melatonin levels are so low that they can never really restore because they're stuck in that cycle. So, as other people that tend to be more relaxed and laid back and less vigilant, they just have a natural amount of those metabolites, and they naturally have very profound and lucid dreams. So I think that the inner vision quest that so many ancient cultures talked about is to open that door. I don't call the pineal gland the third eye, I call it the first eye, because it's really where the vision takes place. And when that system activates, we've seen this. In fact, we can induce it now. I can show you 20 more of those. We actually know that we know how to induce that. When that system switches on, that person just says, wow. You know, if someone says to you, well, I was traveling down the tunnel, and you know, you would be like, yeah, nice. You know, I would say, okay, great. But when you see their scan and they tell you that, you're like, yeah, you probably were. Yeah, maybe. What the hell? What was happening to you? And there's always this profound, life-changing moment for them. That person it will never be the same after that experience, because the stronger the energy, the emotion that they feel, the more they're going to pay attention to the pictures in their mind, and they're creating a long-term memory. And now they have new fabric neurologically in their brain to perceive the world a little differently. So I'm interested in the mystical, and that's the system that switches on.
Joe, I just have to ask a question. So studies are showing...
Can I ask him a question?
Yeah!
Studies show that we produce the highest levels of DMT naturally two times in our lives, when we were born, coming into this world, and through the death process. So with you, is it fair to say that the death process to us could feel like a lucid dream that you simply don't wake up?
Absolutely. And if you've ever been with someone, we talked about this.
Well, I'm thinking about my friend.
We talked about this in your business.
Yeah.
That just before death, sometimes there's this 24-hour cycle where people get super lucid. Super lucid, and they almost turn into the child that they always wanted to be. And that's usually a sign that the brain chemistry is changing right before they transition. Yeah. And if a person is in an altered state like a coma, don't ever think that they're not aware
of where they are.
Especially right the moments before they are. They are in the room, around the room, they are the room, they're the space in there, and at birth and at death, because that, I think that is the, that's when the door opens.
Thank you, Jim. Okay, we're going to do the lightning round now.
Pick one up there. And to make it short, concise, not a long story.
Many of us work in healthcare settings, hospice, end of life, neonatal intensive care, beginning of life, Parkinson's, neurological. To take what you're teaching into an allopathic setting.
He's 5 minutes and 53 seconds.
I have a very interesting question. How are you breaking the consciousness ceiling of the allopathic model right now? And how many of you are actually working in real life settings in healthcare and hospitals and hospice? And how do we break that ceiling?
By the way, this guy is the father of epigenetics.
To support the sustainable development goals through the year 2030. allopathic medicine is implicit in about six of those goals, and the way that we are treating childhood disease, women's issues, all of those things are in sustainable development goals. So this is a doorway in through the United Nations, working with organizations across the world, not just in the West, but in, you know, in Africa and in Asia and places like that, to bring these new ideas. And I just want to say, Ilan Cohen is responsible for where a lot of this information comes from, events like this. There are medical doctors in this conference and many of our conferences who come up to us and they say, you just told us about the discovery of 40,000 sensory neurites in the human heart that influence the brain. Why don't we know about that? Why aren't we taught that in the university? Why am I not teaching my students this? So it's through this that the information is being disseminated as well. So through conferences and through UN. So, and thank you.
Right here. Janice, thank you. How do you do that, Mike? With the mic, please, so everyone can hear you. Here she is, right now.
Hi, I'm just wondering about if you guys have done yoga, nidra, and different meditation forms, and if they can all achieve what we're talking about here today.
What was the first part of the question?
If the research has been done in yoga nidra, now we lay down and go into.
So
nidra, yes, I can say it.
Can you pronounce it again?
Yoga nidra?
Yeah, there's tons of information.
There's only one.
Also known
as yoga nidra.
N-I-D-R-A.
We lay down in.
Do you have another question?
And so what the studies are showing is in all forms of yoga, martial arts that are linked to the yoga, meditative experiences, qigong, they are all influencing energetic systems in the body that have not typically been acknowledged in the past. And because of the universal nature of those studies, it's not just like one study here, one study there. They're everywhere. So now the professors, medical doctors have to make a choice. They either want to live in the real world and accept what the evidence is sharing with them, or they want to live in a make-believe world of the past, and those are the ones that are going out of business because people aren't working with them any longer. So the answer I have seen personally, and I've published in some of my books, very specific forms of yoga. When I was with the Tibetans, there were medical doctors there measuring what was happening with them. And I think what it says, it's not that we should follow one path or another or another or another. The better we know ourselves, the better equipped we are to deal with a changing world, the less we fear the change, the less we fear our own power. And as we embrace the fact that we are multidimensional beings and that we are self-regulating beings, this is what I'm going to talk about at 3 o'clock. We're given the unique gift of self-regulation. All of these things then come into play to help us to awaken that self-regulation of our biology and our lives in a way that no other form of life can do. No other form of life. So it is a powerful internal technology. And I think we're only beginning in the West to understand. Our ancestors and indigenous people have lived this for 5,000 years. This is where science and spirituality come together. That's why we have this conference.